In this true crime Law and Order podcast, the episodes are presented by two separate yet equally ridiculous individuals, one who researches the actual crime and the other who recaps the episode. These are their stories.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's probably afternoon over there, though.
Barely.
Barely. The time changed today.
Oh, was that today?
Yeah, apparently.
Oh, you know what? That makes more... You know, I'm so dumb. We went to a bagel shop this morning, and It's the one we normally go to when we can. And the woman there was like, oh, she said something about, like, getting an hour.
Yeah.
And it was just in the huss of people around, and I kind of just barely heard it and just did that thing when you kind of hear something but you don't have time to respond.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh yeah, and I didn't really realize what she had said, and that makes sense.
Speaking of things that you're not sure what somebody said, did you just say in the huss?
Yeah, I think I meant to say like the hustle and bustle, and I just shortened it to huss.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well,
this is the finale.
It is. I can't believe it.
I can't believe it either. What are we talking about this week before we get into it?
Well, speaking of Farmer's Almanac, I came across a show that my friend recommended to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've both watched Love is Blind, and she texted me and said that there's a new show that I have to watch called Love Off the Grid. And it's a show that I couldn't find it for free anywhere, so we had to, like, sign up for a free trial of Discovery Plus.
I almost did that the other day for one of the things
so
I watched.
Annoying. But the premise of the show is it's not really a dating show. It's more like a show that documents people who are dating, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, the premise isn't, oh, at the end, will you be together or
right.
not? Like, it's not that kind of format.
They're just already together, and they happen to be in a relationship.
Exactly. But it's, the premise of it is, there is one person who literally lives, like, off the grid, like, they don't have electricity or running water, da-da-da-da-da, and this person that they're dating is, like, coming to live with them at whatever that property is that they own.
Okay.
So, like, one person lives in the middle of the Mojave Desert, another one lives on the top of a mountain in North Carolina, and it's really interesting. Like, it's, again, it's not really, like, a dating show, so the sort of, like, will they, won't they, doesn't feel as high stakes as it typically does for that kind of show, but, man, it is wild what some people are willing, like, actively choosing to make their lives like.
Yeah.
Like the guy on the mountain in North Carolina, his water source is like a stream from the top of the mountain, and it just like dried up. And so he no longer has like water to shower in or, you know, drink or whatever. I could live that remotely. Most of these people are on, like, at least 5 acres, but some of them are, like, 50 acres or more. Like, the guy in North Carolina has an entire forest that's just his. And I think that's so cool. And I think I could live that remotely, but I could only live that remotely if I had electricity, running water, and internet.
Yeah. So. Yeah, totally. I like that idea and concept.
Yeah.
A lot of respect for people who can do that kind of thing.
Yes.
I only want to live in a forest all by myself like that if forests are like how they are in video games and
cartoons.
I
knew you were going to say that. Like if little birds brought you food every morning.
Yeah, if magical things would happen and I would be a part of it. And, you know, we just... Have you ever watched the cartoon Hilda?
I've seen like one episode, I think.
So good. But if it was like that there.
Yeah.
I could do that.
If my dog, Shawnee, was there to grant wishes and answer the riddles of the universe.
Exactly. Exactly.
And there's a lot of bugs and wildlife. Like the guy in North Carolina had to deal with a bear on his front porch. And the woman who lives in the Mojave Desert just like full on killed a rattlesnake with a shovel. Like it was just, it's wild. I could never, ever do it.
No, me neither. I can't even have a non-contactless delivery to my door anymore. So killing a rattlesnake with a shovel to eat, that's a
lot
of work.
Can I tell you the rage that I feel when I select, like, please ring bell and leave it door, and somebody rings the bell and stands there to hand it to me? I'm like, I don't wish to be seen right now. Please, please leave the food on the ground so that I can collect it like a little goblin and go back inside my house.
Exactly. I'm tired of staring out the window or trying not to be seen, waiting for the people to go away.
Right. You're the woman in the window across the house from the street.
I am.
Did you, you watched that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we talked about it last week.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Speaking of things I watched that we talked about.
Yes.
You had talked about the docuseries Wild Crimes.
Yes.
And I watched it the other day.
Oof. This is the guy who pushed his wife off a mountain?
Yeah, allegedly. Come on.
Allegedly, I guess. Yeah, I should say that.
He... I'd heard
Although
the story
he's in jail,
a little bit.
Isn't he?
I think he is, right?
Okay.
He
I think so, yeah.
He still asserts his innocence for both crimes, but...
it's like,
wow.
It's one of those ones where... If, you know, when it goes to trial, if you were a juror, I know you're supposed to, like, look at the evidence, like, really, you know, matter-of-factly, but you kind of look at all that evidence and go, like, how could this be anything
else than murder?
Like, come on.
He would have to be the unluckiest person
yes?
in the whole world for
exactly.
any other version of events to have happened.
Yes.
I couldn't believe it. Wild Crimes is the correct title for that one.
Very that, yeah. Did you enjoyed it?
Oh, I loved it. I learned a lot of... I've seen this case in a Dateline or 2020 before, for sure. Mm. Mm-hmm. But since this was, like, multiple episodes and had, like, people... Lots of interviews with people that were involved and family members and stuff, I learned so much more that, even further cemented my feeling towards
Guilt.
Guilt, thank you. I was just about to ask you, what's the opposite of innocence? Where am I? I have one recommendation.
Okay.
A colleague of mine at work mentioned so I already I already listened to the Glennon Doyle podcast, We Can Do Hard
yes.
Things. I'm a huge fan of her, huge fan of her podcast. And I learned about her podcast because of her appearance on Brené Brown's podcast.
Uh-huh.
And when I heard Glennon Doyle's episode on Brené Brown's podcast, it really just affected me in a major way. It helped me so much with my own mental health journey. It was like a supplement to my therapy. I got her book. I got all in, and then I became like a Glennon Doyle head, right?
Yeah.
Now on Glennon Doyle's podcast, I just had a similar experience from this episode I just listened to.
Uh-huh.
And she interviews someone named Alok.
Mm-hmm. We brought Alok to campus recently, in the last month and a half.
I was just going to ask you what your thoughts are on them.
I like them. I think I wish I could have gone to their talk because I wanted to, but I had a conflict.
Mm. I had not heard of them before. I am just... I feel like the same way I did when I heard the Glennon Doyle podcast of Brené Brown, I feel this way about Alok. I'm going to become an Alok head. I have, in that one episode, and the title of the episode is What Makes Us Beautiful, What Makes Us Free.
Hmm.
I have never learned more from one podcast episode, I feel like.
Wow.
About the non-binary trans community, about the queer community, about... humanity, about gender, and we talked a lot last week about gender and masculinity in our episode, which by the way, I've only heard so many amazing things from people about things that we talked about on that episode, so thank you again for covering that case so well.
Thank you.
But I just feel like a renewed sense of like self. I don't even know how to, it's corny, but I just couldn't say enough how easy to understand the conversation between Alok and the hosts of this podcast are. And if you're looking for something to just get an idea about people outside of yourself, maybe, or your own community, if you identify as trans or non-binary. I just highly recommend listening to an episode of this podcast. It's free on, you know, Spotify or whatever, wherever you find podcasts. so good. And I'm so grateful. So
And it's Glenn and Doyle's podcast that they're on?
Yeah, Glenn and Doyle's podcast, We Can Do Hard Things. The episodes, she has two episodes with Alok. One is more of a question and answer after this episode that I'm talking about, but... Let me tell you, the title is so accurate. What makes us beautiful? What makes us free? I learned so much about, like, accepting my body from listening to this episode. Really just amazing. So highly, highly, highly recommend before we dive into some more grim topics.
Well, speaking of, should we get into the episode?
We absolutely should.
All right. Well, I am the episode recapper, and this is the finale episode of season 3 of Law and Order, titled Benevolence, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I think, by the way, this is going to be Cragen's final episode.
Oh, no kidding. Really?
Yeah, I think Captain Cragen, this is certainly his last season as a full-time, like, captain.
Okay. Interesting.
Because he goes over to SVU.
Oh, got it.
And then we get who will be the new captain for most of the series soon.
Do I know who that person is yet?
Yeah, you've seen her before. She's been actually a guest on the show before, but now she's going to be full-time.
We get a woman captain?
Yes, a woman of color, actually.
Awesome. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I'm excited.
Yeah, and then I think also Robinette might be bowing out soon for a new DA.
Gotcha. So, okay.
Say your goodbyes, maybe.
Bye-bye. All right. So this episode opens on two women in an elevator complaining about ticket prices and surcharges. And I was just thinking to myself, if you only knew where ticket prices and surcharges were heading in the future.
Right.
They are, like, getting out of their apartment the elevator in their apartment building, and they walk into their apartment, and the older woman, who I originally thought was the younger woman's mom, but I guess it's her aunt, doesn't really matter, because they are just our sort of...
Discoverers.
Discoverers, yes. They walk in, and they immediately start talking about a bad smell, and the woman's like, take that tuna fish that I threw out and take it outside. And I was like, oh, girl, that's not going to be tuna fish. It's going to be a dead body.
Yeah.
Turns out I was wrong. That was not where the episode was heading. Did you think the same thing,
though? I did, 100%.
Exactly. Anytime there's somebody on a true crime show mentions a bad smell, I'm like, ooh, here we go.
Tom's dead.
So the younger – this opening scene also was – very long and unnecessarily long, I thought, for the amount of setup that it gave us. But essentially, the younger woman kind of like puts around the apartment a little bit and goes to open a window to get rid of the tuna fish smell. And she sees two people down in the alley below the apartment. And I thought a car. Then she kind of walks away, and then we hear a woman screaming. It was a very intense scream. I feel like whoever did that scream should be in horror movies, because it was pretty good.
It was really good. I remember it, and I watched this days ago, so that shows you how much it was good.
So the cops arrive, and Logan and Briscoe are there, and they come across the dead body of a woman named Kathleen McKenna, who is a student at some nearby university. And Briscoe, in his very, tender and respectful way, says, guess she doesn't need to worry about midterms. Okay. She's been strangled, and I guess there's some of her blood on one of the walls in the alley as well. And Logan goes over and talks to the two women who were in the elevator about this woman, and they ask who if they knew her, and she says, oh yeah, Kathy, she lived on the third floor. And the younger woman says that she saw some people signing, and Logan says, signing? And it's so funny because my first thought was like gang signs, but no. Turns out Kathleen was deaf and she was signing to this person. So then we get the title sequence, and I've been we're doing a bit of yard work at the house, and so I decided that I wanted to plant some succulents. So rather than going and buying some succulents, I walked around my neighborhood and took some little cuttings of succulents and then let them dry out for a few days to kind of callus over. And then I put them in some soil to establish some roots, and then once they kind of were a little more established, I ended up planting them. And right around then, the title sequence ends, and we get back to the episode.
I, number one, when I lived in Santa Barbara,
I constantly thought about doing that.
Uh-huh.
But I never had the, I knew I'd never actually be able to make it happen. I'm infamous for killing all plants.
Oh, yeah.
And then secondly...
Well, there's three succulents that are currently in my office that belong to you that are still alive.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked they're still alive. That was a miracle.
Yeah.
And then secondly, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I hope that title sequences remain as long so we can keep doing these activities.
Honestly. I mean, it's a nice way to kind of get some projects done,
definitely,
I feel like.
Definitely.
So when we come back, they are inside of Kathy's apartment, and the landlady is saying that Kathy was an ideal tenant. They find a bunch of photos of Kathy with some friends, a bunch of guys that she's friends with. And then somebody says that the boyfriend is here, and the boyfriend of Kathy, who's, again, the murder victim, shows up, and his name is Ben Freed, and he's like, this is all my fault. And they're like, huh? And he says that they were supposed to go out, but she said she had to see somebody but didn't say who it was. So he says to the detectives, like, oh, we were going to go to the library. We were going to meet at the library. I was there studying for exams. So that's his alibi. At the station, they discuss that they think it's some other guy in one of the photos with Kathy and not the boyfriend because he was at the library.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Kathy's parents show up at the station, and Logan and Briscoe kind of take them through all the photographs that they found in Kathy's apartment to try to figure out who these people are. And they point out a man named Paul, and he was a friend of Kathy's who is also deaf. And he, I guess maybe they dated a couple of times, but... you know, they said Kathy wasn't really interested in him. She was really independent. And they talk about how Kathy was maybe going to get a cochlear implant, which would have restored some of her hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And the dad says, go and talk to Corinne Sussman, who is Kathy's old roommate. And so we go to talk with Corinne, and they're doing a little walk around conversation at a university. And she says that Kathy had boyfriends, and they're like, really? And she's like, yeah, the problem was her hearing, not the rest of her. This episode, by the way, I am not a member of the deaf community. I can't speak to how respectfully they treat it. I think overall they actually do okay.
Yeah, I think I read online that the majority or all of the actors who are portraying deaf folks on the show are actually... deaf actors.
Yeah.
So I thought that that was a good sign.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
So, you know, they ask, was there anyone besides Ben that she was interested in? And she says, no, Ben was definitely her main guy. Like she was the one, or he was the one she was dating. And they ask her about Paul, who is the other guy in the photo that the parents identified.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically paints Paul as this kind of, like, pathetic character who, like, Kathy went out with maybe because she was sorry for him. Which, don't date people because you're sorry for them.
No.
But he says that she says that Paul was really territorial and jealous. And she says, you know, she never would have slept with Paul. He was just a relic from her days at the Institute for the Deaf, which is where they met.
Mm-hmm.
So they head there to the Institute for the Deaf, and they're talking to a woman who is like the secretary at the institute, and she says that she doesn't have Paul's home address, but she knows where he works. Meanwhile, the head of the institute, a man named Gordon Bryce, comes in, and he talks to them about Kathy. And he says that he was, the night of Kathy's murder, he was with a donor family called the Brinkmans, who were giving the money to start some program, and it was a program that he wanted Kathy to run. Like, he said, once we get this donation money, we're going to set up this program, and Kathy's going to run it for us. So, of course, I wouldn't have killed her because, you know, she was a big part of the institute, a big part of my life. I wanted her to take on this new initiative.
Yeah.
They ask him about Paul, and he says, oh, you know, Paul's not really her type. He was a sweet boy, but he's very shy, and Kathy's, like, kind of out of his league, essentially. And he says Paul doesn't really have much experience with women, but he points them to where Paul works so that they can go question him, which is an auto shop. And they talk to, I guess, the head mechanic at the auto shop. And he says that Paul's a great mechanic, but, you know, he did see him with Kathy a couple of times. And the most recent time, Kathy was really upset with him. And he says that she kicked his toolbox across the shop. It sounds like they may have had some kind of argument.
I mean, she must have been strong to kick a mechanic's toolbox across a shop.
I thought the same thing.
She-Hulk? Like, who could do
honestly,
that?
Honestly, toolboxes are very heavy.
The toolbox in my closet is heavy, and I am not a handyman by any right. stretch of the imagination.
So, they go to inquire about Paul at his apartment, and he doesn't answer, but the super lets them in. And inside of Paul's apartment, they see today's newspaper, so they know he's been there today. And they also see kind of a wall collage of photographs of Kathy that kind of indicate maybe he was a little obsessed with her.
Yeah, it's a little bit Helga, hey Arnold.
yes. Meanwhile, they also see a pamphlet in his apartment that says, "Stop cochlear implants." And the super kind of makes an analogy that Paul and Kathy were both parts of the deaf community, but Paul was part of this organization that thought that things like cochlear implants were bad because it's like implying that being deaf is bad and, you know, it's something to be ashamed of. And he makes an analogy of like a deaf person getting a cochlear implant is like a black person turning white. And I don't think that that is a fair comparison.
I don't think
all.
So. At all, whatsoever.
Anyway, they go to the headquarters of this organization that's against cochlear implants and talk to some folks there. And the rhythm is going to get you because DeBarge is there as the person that they are talking to. He has the most intense mullet I have seen. It's pretty awesome. And he says that Kathy was ashamed of being deaf. And, you know, Paul was just trying to convince her not to get a cochlear implant, and Paul and the other folks at this organization were upset that Kathy was dating this new man, Ben, her boyfriend, and he's a hearing man, and Paul didn't really know what to do. Meanwhile, they walk outside and then kind of like magically find Paul and arrest him, or not, don't really arrest him, but they take him down to the station for questioning. And it seems like Paul isn't really willing to talk to them very much. He's kind of keeping silent. But ultimately, he tells them that he was working at the garage until 6, and then he went to a friend's house named Richard with his other friend Gina. So he's got a couple of people attesting to his whereabouts. Dr. Bryce, the head of the institute, comes in while Paul is being questioned, and he wants to be in the interrogation room with Paul because I guess he really cares about him. Once that happens, Paul opens up a little bit more, and he talks about Kathy and says, you know, we were in the same classes. We, you know, worked at the institute together or attended the institute together, but I haven't seen her in a couple of weeks. And he says he read about Kathy's murder in the newspaper, and the reason he was hiding from the police was he was just scared when he heard the police were looking for him. But he tells them that when Kathy broke up with him, he accepted it, and he didn't kill her. In the police station, we get a scene where we learn that Kathy had no DNA under her fingernails, and there's no DNA on Paul's jacket that matches Kathy, so they think probably Paul is actually telling the truth and did not murder Kathy. But then suddenly a man, you know, the guy who walks in and hands people evidence, walks in and hands them evidence of call records to Kathy's apartment. Now, because Kathy is deaf, she has a device that turns like speech into written text for phone calls so that she can receive phone calls. And they see that there are a lot of calls from Paul's apartment to Kathy's. And they're like, oh, well, you know, if she was deaf, maybe she kept the printouts or, you know, there were printouts of these phone calls. Maybe she kept them. So they go to her apartment, but they don't see, they can't find any printouts of the of all of these phone calls that she received. But then they decide to go through the garbage. So we get a trash discovery.
A big one.
A big one. And they're kind of searching through all this garbage. And Logan says, this person just eats donuts and buys Stroke magazines, which I think is meant to be like adult magazines, but possibly the worst way you could say that
right?
phrase. But they do find printouts of conversations that Kathy has had with somebody. And these conversations are like the length of a CVS receipt. And two of the transcripts that they find show a conversation between her and Paul. And then they find a third one that conveniently doesn't show who the person is that was talking to Kathy, but it has the following quote. At least give me a chance to talk you out of this. You want an easy way out, but you owe me. You hang up, you bitch, I'll kill you, I'll kill you.
Damn.
And that phone call was the day that she was killed. So they think, you know, we've got two transcripts that show Paul calling, and then this one, they think maybe Paul actually is the murderer, so they go and arrest him. And then we get a scene of him being questioned with his lawyer, who was played by Cameron Manheim.
Oh, I got so excited because I really
I did too. I love her. And she was also, so she's Paul's lawyer, and she was signing with Paul, and I didn't actually Google it, but I wonder if she actually speaks ASL.
She does.
Or
I looked it up.
She does.
She before okay. she was an actress, she was a interpreter.
Okay. Because the whole time I was like wondering if she learned it for this part.
Yeah, I was very impressed by that. And then a strange thing happened, and I'm sure this has happened to you because I feel like this is like a, I'm sure there's a word for this phenomenon, and it's not really a phenomenon, but you know when you hear something that you haven't heard in a while, or you see someone you haven't seen on TV in a while, and then they're just showing up everywhere?
Yes.
Literally after I watched this episode and saw Cameron Manheim, and I was like, oh, I haven't seen her in something in a while, I put on the TV show This Is Us.
Oh, and she was on
it? She's not a cast member. She's never been on the show before. It's in its like final season now. And the episode that I started with, she was a guest cast member.
How weird.
I
that is so strange.
Blown away.
So they're questioning him about his alibi, and he says that he just lied to the police because he was scared. He said he did see Kathy the night of her murder. They met for dinner or coffee at a cafe, and she went back to her place, and he says that when they parted ways, she was standing on the sidewalk, and she was alive. And he says that the waitress at the cafe will testify that our conversation was calm and rational. We were not arguing. We were not upset with each other. I did not kill her.
Hmm.
But Stone asks him about the transcript that shows those threats to Kathy. And he says that that wasn't him. But Stone says, you know, I'll offer you man one if you confess. And he's like, no, I didn't do it. And Cameron Manheim is pretty great at just being like, you have no case, goodbye.
Wait, okay, this is weird. Before we what? Move on,
okay.
I just was Googling Cameron Manheim just to see.
Yeah.
She's in the new Law & Order season, like the new one, as a main cast member.
Oh, weird.
What the hell is going on?
It's like the Mandela effect.
Wow, thing. This is, yeah, this was not planned.
Okay. No. All right. So they go back to Stone's office, and in Stone's office, they're talking to Dr. Bryce, the head of the institute, and he says that he doesn't want Paul to be associated with the institute. You know, essentially is kind of like asking Stone to get the institute's name out of the papers because it will scare off donors. And he says, you know, he's talking to them about Kathy, and he says she was incredibly dedicated and a great person to work with at the Institute. And Stone thinks that even if they do think that Paul killed Kathy, that a jury will ultimately be sympathetic to Paul because he's deaf. And so he's like, well, our case is pretty circumstantial, and a jury will likely be sympathetic to him. So not really a great strong case.
Mm.
So they decide to do a little bit more investigation, and Robinette heads to a university to talk to a professor about ASL. And the professor explains that a word-for-word translation of ASL into English would kind of come out as broken English because it's not like a one-to-one translation. He says, deaf people learn regular English grammar, but ASL kind of condenses some things and, you know, leaves...
Like any other language,
it's not a direct translation,
like, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like any other language, you know, there's going to be miscommunications if you're doing a direct, like, Babelfish translation.
Exactly. But he says that, you know, when deaf folks are talking on the phone, they will still speak in a way that indicates that they are an ASL speaker. Like, there's linguistics patterns of deaf folks when they are speaking with each other, even if they're not using ASL. Mm-hmm. And so he explains to them that this transcript indicates that the person making these threats to Kathy was a hearing person, because he says, like, that deaf folks, when they're speaking using ASL or, you know, are on the phone with each other, don't use the word at or, you know, other things. So it he's like, this is very likely a hearing person who was talking to Kathy on the phone. Mm-hmm. But in Paul's other transcripts, those words are missing. So it's like, okay, yes, these two innocent phone calls were Paul. This one with all the threats was likely a hearing person. And so now they're like, okay, maybe it's her new boyfriend, Ben, who killed her. So they go talk to him. And he is maintaining his innocence. He says he was in love with Kathy and that they were going to move to California together because they were both going to go to USC for their MSW program. And Kathy was just waiting for a letter of recommendation from Dr. Bryce, the head of the institute. So they're like, huh, okay, well, Dr. Bryce is a hearing person. He was starting this new program that he wanted Kathy to run, but the story we're getting from the boyfriend about Kathy is that she was leaving to go to California, so maybe it was Dr. Bryce who did this. Mm-hmm. So then we get a scene that really doesn't matter, but they go and talk with one of the donors, and he was the person who was kind of Dr. Bryce's alibi originally, but he ends up giving Stone and Robinette information that indicates, like, no, he could have possibly done this. But he says, you know, even though he's giving them that information, he doesn't think he would have killed Kathy. You know, he says he loved Kathy. They were important to each other, both for the Institute and maybe they were. Maybe he was in love with Kathy. It's unclear.
Hmm.
Meanwhile, they go and talk to Dr. Bryce's ex-wife, and we get basically a story of him being sort of a, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, but he's like really committed to causes, essentially. And that was what mattered to him above relationships with anyone else, was like being committed to a cause. And so the Institute was the most important thing to him in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They get Dr. Bryce's call logs and see that there were three calls to Kathy's apartment the day of her murder. And so now they're thinking, all right, Kathy was leaving to go to California and Dr. Bryce wasn't willing to let her go. And so in like a fit of rage, he killed her. They get a search warrant for Dr. Bryce's apartment and they find a pair of gloves that have Kathy's blood on them. And so now they have enough information to arrest Dr. Bryce. He, meanwhile, tells them that, oh, no, I couldn't have done it. I was at my assistant's house until after Kathy's murder. That was the woman we saw at the very beginning of the episode when they first get to the Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So they're thinking maybe that he and his secretary were having a relationship and the secretary is covering up for him, like covering up the fact that he murdered Kathy. So they go and look at the financials and like the articles of incorporation for the nonprofit or whatever those legal papers are. And what they see is that the secretary, the week after Kathy was murdered, new papers were drawn up for the nonprofit that name the secretary as the vice president. And so they're like, okay, maybe she's in on all of this. So they talk to her, and essentially they kind of like badger her into confessing that she was covering up for him, that she was promised that she would become VP if once Kathy left, but she didn't really know that he had killed her. He just asked her to say that they were together the night of her murder. So she gets immunity in exchange for her cooperation. Mm-hmm. And they talk to Dr. Bryce, and he says that, you know, he doesn't want the Institute to be dragged through the mud because of all of this. And so he agrees to confess to manslaughter 2 and to serve 18 months in order to protect the Institute. And they're like, no, that's not going to fly. So meanwhile, they get the secretary to give them additional information. She says that she has kept all of the transcripts of all of the calls that Dr. Bryce made to Kathy. And so she gives those to Stone, and they show the exact transcript of the threats that Kathy's machine had received. So now they know it was Dr. Bryce who made those threats. He asked the secretary to cover up for him, and so he is very likely Kathy's murderer, and so they're gonna take him to court. He, however, has a really good lawyer, and they kind of have a few, like, battle of the wits, and finally Stone offers him a plea of manslaughter 1, which he ultimately accepts in order to protect the Institute, and he says that Kathy was like everything to him. He taught her to speak, how to present herself. She shared everything with me. She was there for the Institute, and I worked my whole life for her, and she was just leaving us to go to USC. So that kind of wraps up the episode, and it's a really weird episode because it kind of just ends on a, like, anticlimactic note.
Yeah, there's like, no finality feeling to it.
No, none at all. He's just like, okay, yeah, I did it. And then we're like, all right, end of the episode.
See ya. So
that is the final episode of season 3, episode 22, Benevolence.
Benevolence. Well done.
Thanks.
Yeah, I found this episode a little confusing, but I guess we'll talk about more of that at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. There were several times where I was like, should I be paying attention to this, or am I getting, like, poorly written red herrings kind of things?
100%. I was like, which storyline are we ultimately going to go down here?
Right.
Well, are you ready to hear the inspiration?
I am super ready.
Okay. Well, this episode was technically not based on anything.
Gosh, I feel like the later half of the season, they were just like, eh, let's make things up.
Yeah, like, I feel like every 3, we're getting a real ripped one. Mm-hmm. I looked up cases, though, and I found one that I feel like this very easily could have been based on the timing of it. Okay. So I'm going to talk about the Gallaudet University murders.
Okay.
Have you heard of this?
I don't think so.
Okay, I hadn't either. First, I will try to set the scene a little bit by giving some background about where most of this takes place, which is at Gallaudet University.
And where is that?
It's in Washington, D.C. So Gallaudet University, according to their mission statement, is a, quote, bilingual, diverse, multicultural institution of higher education that ensures the intellectual and professional advancement of deaf and hard of hearing individuals through American Sign Language and English.
Okay.
It is currently the world's only university in which all programs and services are specifically designed to accommodate deaf and hard of hearing students. Mm-hmm. That's pretty major. I can't believe it's the only one.
Yeah.
So, and in all of the research I did, this is echoed, like, to be true. So it's a school that members of the deaf community worldwide often aspire to go to. It's got a lot of notable alumni, including Linda Bove, who played herself on Sesame Street, which was my first experience with someone deaf at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Niall DeMarco of America's Next Top Model and Dancing with the Stars fame. Heidi Zimmer, the first deaf woman to reach the top of Mount McKinley, Mount
Elbrus and Mount Kilimanjaro.
Wow.
There are tons of other alumni that are like world-class educators, founders of institutes, scientists, artists, athletes, poets, like tons of really notable people. So really well-known, world-renowned university. Their current vision states that Gallaudet is powerfully showing the value of deaf people across the spectrum of identities. Here, being deaf is not something to overcome, but a process of understanding oneself, building connections within and beyond the signing and deaf community. By extension, our campus is a place where deaf individuals will find affirmative and positive acceptance of who they are and all they have to offer the world. Mm-hmm. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
So it's no wonder then that in the summer of 2000, well, I guess that's why this wasn't based on it. I thought it was a little earlier. in the summer of 2000, 19-year-old Eric Plunkett of Minnesota learns he's been accepted to the university, and he's literally, quite literally jumps for joy. He's always been a very theatrical kid. His reactions to things have always been described as his family as over the top. Growing up, his parents described occasions where if he was told to do yard work that he really didn't want to do, they would find him outside lying flat on the ground raking the leaves. I'm totally that level of drama.
Yeah.
He grows up with a wanderlust very strong that many of his Christmas lists have plane tickets listed on them in place of toys. He's energetic, outgoing. He was born deaf into a hearing household.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
His family, when they find out he's deaf, they learn ASL very quickly, and they teach Eric to view his deafness as a gift. He attends programs for the deaf and hard of hearing throughout his whole school career. And while his cerebral palsy makes it difficult for him to participate in active sports, he's always been very active, independent, and likes to be involved. He successfully attends boarding schools multiple times for the deaf throughout his educational career, and he thrives pretty well on his own. His principal at the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf said he took risks, he accepted challenges, he didn't let anyone say no to him. So upon his acceptance letter being sent to his house, he was at the boarding school in Minnesota. So his family drives out to surprise him. They get balloons, they bring the acceptance letter to Gallaudet, and that's when he sees it, he jumps for joy, and before his parents leave his school, he frames the letter and promises that he's going to replace this acceptance letter with his diploma upon graduating.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So Plunkett, 19 years old, waves goodbye to his parents as he moves into his dorm just before the school year, probably around August of 2000. The campus offers everything that universities geared towards the hearing offer, but unlike said universities, ASL is the dominant language here. English is really just used for written communication.
Okay.
Eric writes home to his mom, Kathleen, pretty much every night via email. He absolutely loves it there. He even quickly joined the Lambda Society, which on campus is an LGBTQ group. And at the beginning of the school year, he is voted secretary of the society.
Okay, cool.
So he's really enjoying his time there. He had never personally come out to his family before this. So this was sort of their interpretation of him coming out, and they were very accepting. He was very excited to be part of a diverse community. Across the hall from him at the Cogswell dorms, that's where he lived, he was in room 101. In room 102, right across, was a classmate. Joseph Mesa was 20 years old, so just about a year older. He was from Guam, where his brother Patrick said, quote, "He proved a lot of people wrong about being disabled. He just went ahead and did things and became a strong influence on both the deaf community and the hearing community." Mesa grew up athletic. He was aspirational to others while living in Guam, and he always encouraged others that there was more to life than the limits of their island. Also in Cogswell was fellow freshman, 19-year-old Ben Varner.
Okay.
He's also starting out the school year here. He's much more reserved than the other two boys that I've described, but he's looking forward to his time in the university, especially because it's in Washington, D.C., and unlike his hometown of San Antonio, Texas, this hosted a much more diverse cultural experience for him, and okay. That's something he always longed for. His immediate family was hearing, and while born legally deaf and having significant challenges with hearing, Benjamin mm-hmm. had worn hearing aids since he was about 8 months old and wasn't completely deaf.
Okay.
His mother, Diane, dedicated her life to being his advocate and tutor, basically. She wanted him to be able to hear and speak as much as possible. Mm-hmm. She said, quote, "I wanted him to be able to pull up to a gas station someday and say, fill it up, or go into a restaurant and say, I want a hamburger without mustard." And Lisa Lopez, not the Lisa Lopez we're thinking of.
Okay.
Lisa Lopez is one of Varner's school counselors that was, you know, closely affiliated with him throughout his, like, grammar school career and high school career. She says, mm-hmm. "Behind every oral deaf kid who really learns how to listen and speak, there is a family member who had to practically dedicate their life toward the success of that child." And she says that his mother was the model of this.
Mm-hmm.
So Benjamin Varner thrived academically. He was basically a straight-A student in school. But he did struggle with issues surrounding his deafness and how he related mm-hmm. to it. Because he could hear some with the aid of the hearing aids, and because he had studied so much to be able to hear and speak, he often mm-hmm. would come home exhausted from school and frustrated because he had to put so much effort into trying to hear and speak like everybody else.
Gotcha.
Something that he shared in common with his class and dorm mate Eric Plunkett was his desire to travel and learn about other cultures. He also mm-hmm. had a pretty strong wanderlust. He was constantly reading travel books, and learning about other cultures was something that he was very passionate about. He was going to be studying Arabic at the Gallaudet University, and mm-hmm. while his family was Baptist, he learned about Islam after doing a project in school, and at mm-hmm. the age of 13, he independently joined the Islamic Center of San Antonio.
Okay.
This is where he started studying the Quran, and he even tried to apply for a visa, I think, an Israeli visa, without his parents knowing. Uh-huh. His parents supported him, and they were fine with him doing this, but they had their own beliefs, and so he did this independently. They would say okay. he even, like, would do the prayers in his room. He was very dedicated. So all three of these boys live on the first floor, and the west end of the dorm was nicknamed the Wild Wild West. Okay. And many of the students, including Eric Plunkett, often left their dorm room doors open, which I remember when I was in college dorming, the short mm-hmm. time I did do that. A lot of my dorm was a one-floor dorm, uh-huh. and so many people left their dorm room doors open. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was a big party, I guess. I did not.
Yeah.
But I remember this was like the sort of atmosphere. It was like everyone kind gotcha. Of wandered in and out of each other's rooms, like just, hey, how's it going? What are you doing? And yeah, so it seems like it was a very fun community for all of them.
Gotcha.
One afternoon, Mesa notices that his across the hall neighbor, Eric Plunkett, hadn't been in math class with him, which was unusual because Eric was pretty passionate about being on time to things and not missing class. So when he gets back to their dorm at Cogswell, he notices that Plunkett's door, which was normally open and inviting, was closed. So he thinks, okay, maybe he's sleeping, overslept. And so he tries to get his attention, and there's no answer. So he thought it was odd. And then later in the day, when the dorm room is still closed and no one has heard from Eric, he goes to report to the RA on their floor, Lauren, what he had noticed. And he also mentions that he had smelled a weird odor coming from the room.
No.
I know, right? So they go to get a male RA, because that's sort of the protocol, because it's a male student. And they immediately see blood on the carpet, which leads them to Eric Plunkett. He is lying on the ground. He's covered in blood. And they immediately call the police and the ambulance. He's pronounced dead on the scene. Eric Plunkett was 19 years old.
No, that's awful.
19. He had just turned 19 about 20 days earlier.
Ugh.
So,
Fear and panic spread immediately through the campus. Eric's parents in Minnesota get a phone call at the same time as a local chaplain rings their bell, and they get the news that they are dreading. Every parent dreads that Eric has passed away, but they get no details on the crime. They just know he has died and that they need to contact Washington, D.C. Police Department for more information. So they booked their first flight out to Washington, D.C., and his mother, Kathleen, kept repeating the whole way there, quote, "I took my baby to school and he's never coming home." Police at the scene can tell right away that this is not an accident. He had been bludgeoned multiple times with the chair in his room. He was strangled and badly beaten. Classes are canceled. They evacuate the dorm. The university, previous to this, had no crime, really. It had been looked at as a sort of safe haven. And while the areas around the university had a high crime rate at the time, even for Washington, D.C., which sometimes has a reputation for crime, while that was true, everyone wondered how someone would have been able to get into the university because the school had a really high gate surrounding it. And there were only four entrances. One is manned by a guard at all times, and the other three get locked after 6 p.m. Also, all the buildings on campus require an ID card to enter. So there's no way someone can get into a building unless someone lets them in or unless they have a student or staff ID.
So it's likely that somebody on the staff or a student was involved.
That is the theory at the time. There's also no forced entry at the scene. So every student kind of is on the lookout for one another. Because it's they're all new students there too. So any freshmen don't really know anybody else. It's pretty suspicious feeling that goes throughout the whole campus. Nobody really knows how to feel. And I watched an interview with one of the students who says that at the time, when they were evacuated, since it was a crime scene, they weren't allowed to go back in and get any of their things for like a while. So lots of the students ended up feeling homeless when they just got here. And they're all on their own, many of them for the first time. And in addition to the fear of what could happen and what had happened, so many of the students were now feeling like completely alone. Which is... I can't even imagine how that that must feel, especially for students who knew Eric. An early theory that arose was whether this was a hate crime or not because of his openly identifying as gay. So other queer students had noted at the time that there were some issues of harassment on campus before this, some, you know, rude epitaphs being put on people's doors or just around campus. One student witnessed another student say, quote, "Great, one less F word," after the death. So that was something that they were investigating pretty early on. A vigil is organized the day after Plunkett's body was found on September 29th, 2000. His parents attend because they are in town to identify the body, unfortunately. And they are greeted with, you know, tons of students who, even though they only knew him for a short period of time, all say they were deeply impacted by Eric. Everyone says how beautiful of a soul he was and how he was so proud of his family. He was constantly showing them pictures of his new baby sister. Every time someone came in the room, he had a new photo to show them. And everyone just is very, very kind and warm towards them and feels terrible, of course. The family have to return to Minnesota afterwards to arrange a funeral, but they have to go back with really no answers to what has happened or why. So one issue that comes up as a challenge for police at the time is that when they're questioning everyone on campus, they have to go through interpreters. And this isn't something that they were fully equipped to deal with in terms of interviewing, at least, because oftentimes in interviews, they rely on inflections in people's voice or other kind of tells through that. And they couldn't really do that here. One name that does come up, though, is 18-year-old Thomas Minch.
Okay.
So Thomas Minch is a freshman as well. He lives in a nearby dorm, but he often hangs out at Cogswell with a lot of the other classmates.
Mm-hmm.
So Joseph Mesa from across the hall said that Thomas Minch, this other freshman, and Eric Plunkett, the victim, had an argument that got physical pretty recently. Mm-hmm. And so they bring Minch in for questioning 5 days after the murder. And they ask him, okay, you know, did you have a relationship with Plunkett? What was going on? We heard about an argument. And there is an allegation that the two may have been romantically involved.
Okay.
So Thomas Minch denies this. He says he's not gay and that they had argued that day, but, you know, it was just an argument. And
right,
they question him for about 6 hours. And in the interview, he admits that he had this argument from him, and it was because of an unwanted advance from Eric. And according to the police transcript, he says that he pushed him to the ground. So with this, they feel they have enough to move forward. And on the day of Eric's funeral, Eric's family gets a call that they have arrested Thomas Minch for this murder.
Okay.
However, the next day, Thomas Minch is released.
Okay.
The DA's office feel that they had very little other than an admission of an argument with him, not enough to really hold him.
Okay.
So a little bit about Thomas Minch. Thomas Minch was born deaf into a mostly non-hearing home. His parents and younger brother were also deaf, and he has several cousins who also were deaf or hard of hearing. So something that was a part of his family that they were very equipped to deal with and handle, you know, so it wasn't like the other boys.
Right.
His family was well known in their New Hampshire home, and most people who met them became inspired to learn ASL because of them. Thomas always strived to do more than what was expected of him. He asked for more responsibilities at work all the time and in school. People usually underestimated him, but he always strove to do more and was successful.
Mm-hmm.
He even broke boundaries in his high school because he performed as the king in their production of Once Upon a Mattress, where he would act on stage and mouth the words, and someone offstage provided the spoken portion. At Gallaudet, he was a member of the theater department, and now he is just getting released from spending the night in jail because of the murder of his alleged friend, Eric.
Yeah.
So, even though he's released, the school does expel Minch, and they increase security. They order about 18 new cameras, they reinforce the locks on all the gates, and all the first floor students get moved to dorms on the fourth floor. This offers most of them little feeling of security, though, because the cameras get ordered, but they're not immediately installed.
Right.
And moving up several floors helps some of them feel more safe. But specifically, the RA, whose name is Lauren, who found the body originally, she remembers that Ben Varner, that third student I was talking about earlier, he's scared. He wants another dorm entirely. He doesn't feel like the fourth floor is really going to do anything. But that wasn't really possible at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So months pass with no word of any new developments. And then on February 3rd, 2001, about four or five months later, fire alarms go off at Cogswell Hall. As they're evacuating the building, they're checking all the rooms, and one RA comes out into the hall and says that someone is dead.
Oh my God, okay.
When they check the room, 19-year-old Ben Varner is found lying face down in his room, murdered.
Whoa.
In a scene that is described as brutal and bloody.
Okay.
He'd been stabbed in the head, neck, and chest at least 15 times and had lots of defensive wounds.
Oof.
He was 19 years old.
No.
Investigators check the scene, and they find in a dumpster out back a paring knife that belonged to Ben, but it's clearly the murder weapon. It's bloody.
Yeah.
And they find a bloody jacket that does not belong to Ben.
Okay.
Ben's family is alerted, and they come to Washington, D.C., and Eric Plunkett's family flies to Washington, D.C. in solidarity because they've just gone through the same thing, and they want to be there for them.
It's kind.
Yeah. In looking for motive or connections to Eric Plunkett's murder, investigators hear a rumor on campus that Benjamin Varner may have also been gay but closeted.
Hmm.
Also, Thomas Minch, who now lives in New Hampshire since he's been expelled.
Yeah.
He had actually been in Washington, D.C. that day, coincidentally, he had to come to D.C. to appear before a grand jury for the previous crime. Hmm. And in that meeting, he was dismissed, but he was in Washington, D.C. at the time of the crime.
Okay.
So police show up immediately at his family home in New Hampshire, and he is able to provide credit card receipts and a full account of what he was doing on the dates surrounding Ben's murder. He's basically able to account for his entire time in Washington, D.C., and they're able to verify everything he says with footage and testimony from places he said he was and receipts and all of that. So,
including around the time of the murder?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And so his whereabouts are completely 100% accounted for, and they know that he wasn't anywhere near the university his entire time in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
So now they're wondering, did we even have the right guy for the first case? But who knows? Because he's still their prime suspect for the original murder. They just don't feel like they have enough to take him in.
Okay.
So now they're focusing their efforts on the current investigation. And through some forensic magic, there's a chemical that they're able to spray on the carpet that reveals a complete bloody footprint.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Most footprints on shoes are pretty specific to that type of shoe, so they're hoping they could find something, and they know it's not one of Benjamin's shoes.
Okay.
Missing from the scene are also Benjamin's checkbook and bank card.
Hmm.
Now, similarly, at Eric Plunkett's murder scene, it was discovered that his bank card was also lifted, but in that instance, by the time they investigated that lead, it had been past 30 days. And the CCTV footage from banks and establishments where debit transactions had been made after Plunkett's death had already been recycled. So they waited too long.
Okay.
So this time, they decide to take a different approach, and they look very quickly into Ben Varner's financial history, and they do find one suspicious piece of activity. A day or two after the murder, a man cashes a check from Ben Varner in the amount of $650 and is caught on CCTV from the bank.
Okay.
That man is Joseph Mesa, the freshman who lived across from Eric Plunkett and had alerted the RA to the foul smell in his room. They bring him in for questioning, and he says that Ben had paid him with a check for computer parts that he sold him. So he was just cashing the check, and maybe the timing isn't great, but he needed the money.
Okay.
Either way, they now have enough to perform a search warrant on Mesa's dorm room. When they do, they find a pair of shoes that match the size and type of the Nike Air Max cross trainers that made the print at the scene.
Okay.
And there's bloodstains on them.
Mm.
So Mesa is arrested. Investigators are expecting a pretty long road ahead of them, and they're prepared for all lines of questioning. In a surprising twist, though, Mesa says, quote, "I knew if I held it in, it would get worse and worse, and it would end up worse than just admitting what had happened." And he confesses to the murder of Benjamin Varner.
But not the first one.
Well, he's not being asked about that one.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, in a taped interview, he says, "I had the knife, I got ready, and I stabbed him until he died."
Ugh.
He says that he found the mic. He gives very specific information. He says that he found the knife under the microwave. He stabbed him in the neck. And he says that Eric looked at him. I'm sorry. He says that Benjamin looked at him. And he says, quote, "I felt guilty, and I knew he'd report me right away. I had to kill him so he dies, and that way he can't report me to the RA or anything."
Hmm.
In the taped interview, he identifies the knife as the murder weapon, And while he's being interviewed, his friends are able to identify the jacket that was found in the dumpster as his jacket.
Okay.
He also says that after he committed the act, he checked on Ben 3 or 4 times, which experts say is consistent with behavior you see in serial murderers, to like kind of relive the experience of the scene.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
He also says that he stared at the body for 20 minutes before he stole the checkbook. He had even put one of Benjamin's T-shirts over his own when he committed the crime, and he still had that T-shirt in his closet.
Ugh, okay.
In the interview, he also says that he started the rumor about Thomas Minch having a relationship with Plunkett.
Oh, yeah,
and he
okay.
also says that he admits to misleading authorities about Ben Varner being closeted and gay. That was completely fabricated.
Got it, okay.
They feel pretty confident with this information that he's responsible for the first murder. And so they say to him, quote, "If you have anything else on your conscience, tell us about it now so it could be all over at once."
Right.
And his reaction is a very cavalier, quote, "Okay, also, Eric Plunkett, I also did that one too."
Yikes. Okay.
Yeah. I've watched the videotaped interview, and it's with interpreters, of course, but his manner is very matter-of-fact, cold. He says, quote, about Eric Plunkett, "I knew that he was kind of weak and limped a little. I put my arm around his neck, kept holding it there continuously, and he breathed slower and slower, and then he laid down." Quote, and then he describes how he murdered him. He describes all of the wounds that happened to Eric that weren't released, such as being kicked after being attacked. And he even voluntarily and coldly demonstrates how he used the chair to bludgeon him to death.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's pretty chilling. So, with this confession, he's charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, and the families of both Plunkett and Varner get calls on February 13th to be told that someone has been arrested. And Ben's family is relieved a little bit. Eric's family feels like they have to kind of hold their breath because this whole thing happened with Minch before, and he was released the next day.
Right.
So they are not willing to put any stake on this, but Eric's family also are pretty chilled to the bone because they remember at the vigil specifically that Joseph came up to them and gave their condolences.
Ugh.
Yeah. Thomas Minch, the previously accused, gets the call that he has been completely cleared and they apologize to him. He says it's a great sense of relief because Minch says he never confessed. And that when he was being interviewed, there were 2 interpreters there, and he can tell that things were getting lost in translation.
Yeah.
He said, quote, I felt lost. What did I say that made them think that I did it? And he talks about how after all of the accusations came out and he was expelled, he lost who he was, and it changed his life in a pretty significant way.
Well, yeah, God.
Yeah. He later tries to sue the police department, but I looked it up, and he was unsuccessful in that lawsuit.
And out of curiosity, how many years between the first murder and this, like, revelation?
Oh, when they find who did it?
Yeah.
Less than a year. It was...
Oh, okay.
I want to say 6 months.
Was Minch, like, admitted back to the school or anything?
He was allowed to come back to the school after this. And okay. I believe he did. And I looked him up. I wasn't able to find anything for sure that it was him, but I found a gentleman named Thomas Minch who lives in Maine who is like an advocate for the disabled community in general and does a lot of work for the deaf community. So it seems like he's gotten his life back together and is doing meaningful things that make him happy. So I hope that is him. The timing works out. The location works out. So I hope that is him because it looks like he has a happy ending.
Nice.
And he's interviewed it specifically in a lot of the – there's a few videos I was able to find, and he's interviewed, and he seems like, you know, while it had a profound impact on his life, he's grateful for, you know, being cleared and the correct person being found. Joseph Mace's motive in the murder was money. And all in all, from the 2 murders, he made about $750.
Ugh.
Okay. And it turns out this was not the first time Mesa was in trouble for theft. Mm. A classmate of his from a boarding school that he attended said that he stole $45 out of his wallet, but was also very generous with money. And in his senior yearbook, Mesa was even named most likely to be rich in the future. During a college prep program sponsored by Gallaudet University that Mesa attended in 1999, Mesa stole his roommate Delvin Arnold's ATM card and withdrew $3,000.
Yikes.
When this happened, he was suspended for a year and ordered to pay Arnold back, which he did. And then he returned to Gallaudet University as a freshman in 2000. So just one year prior to this, he was found guilty of stealing $3,000 from a roommate and now back at the university the next year.
Got it.
But because the motive of Plunkett's murder was not looked at as financial, they never even looked at his across-the-hall neighbor. They hadn't even considered his missing ATM card until it seemed way too late. And by that time, they still, for some reason, didn't have Mesa on their radar.
That does seem like a big oversight.
Yeah. Yeah. Many believe that if this was investigated correctly, that Benjamin Varner would still be alive today. And D.C. Metro Police issued a statement that says, "Hindsight is 20/20. Is it possible mistakes were made? Yes, of course. We are deeply saddened by the murder of students in our community." Mm. That's it.
Wow.
9 months after the murder is when the trial is set.
Okay.
And Mesa is going to plead insanity.
Hmm.
During an interview in custody, he stood up and gesticulated putting kittens in a bag and stomping on them. And he smiled while doing it, saying that as a young boy, he would kill animals.
Oh my God.
He also says that he would have hallucinations of black gloved hands signing to him to do violence. And specifically, his last hallucination was of the wrestler, the Undertaker, in his black gloves signing him to do it.
Okay.
Right. They find a letter, however, that he wrote to his girlfriend while he was in custody, that he was going to fake an insanity defense.
Huh. Shock.
Yeah. So, this is all produced at the trial, and after the trial concludes, less than 3 hours of deliberation go on, and the jury comes back and finds him guilty of all counts.
Mm-hmm.
He is convicted and sentenced to life with no parole, with an additional 90 years for all of the theft charges. Diane Varner, Benjamin's mother, says, "I'm still numb. A year and 3 months ago, I came here to pick up my son's body, and I have yet to get over that numbness. There's little significance in the verdict other than the fact that Joseph will never be able to do this to any other family again."
Yeah.
Mesa, a couple years after, he tries to appeal based on some, like, nonsense bullshit. Like, I looked it up, and he basically was saying, oh, they shouldn't have been able to use my girlfriend's letter because we have a common law marriage, and she shouldn't have been able to testify against me.
Right.
But there was no evidence that there was any such common law marriage. They were just dating. And so that was thrown out. He also tries to say that his interpreters during his confession were not qualified and they didn't pass like the bar for what they needed to pass to be interpreters. And he claimed that they were supplied by the university. But they were – or the police station, and they weren't, like, qualified, but they were supplied by the university, and they were all – they all had their certifications. They all had everything they needed to have to be doing what they were doing. So that was thrown out, too. So he – I looked it up. He is still incarcerated in Sheridan, Oregon's Federal Detention Center. He's listed as a life in prison. There's no possibility for parole. And – Diane Varner, Benjamin's mother, said, quote, "They'd better alert that prison that Mesa is very dangerous." And Kathleen Cornell's Eric Plunkett's mother added, "Don't make another mother go through what I had to do."
Yeah.
Thomas Minch said if he could say one thing to the family of Eric Plunkett, he has no hard feelings, of course, about them suspecting him at first.
Right.
He says, "Your son was a wonderful person. He had a great heart. and he always had a smile on his face, and I want you to remember that. And at the memorial for Benjamin Varner, family friend Warren Branch said, I know right now you're up there asking all your questions. You're up there asking, where are the gates? How do I get these wings to fit? And Omar Shakir from the Islamic Center of San Antonio added, to the bereaved family and friends, we greet you in peace. It is our pleasure and honor to remember such a worthy human being. And that is the story of the Gallaudet murders and the murders of Eric Plunkett and Ben Varner.
That's wild. Great job.
Thank you. Yeah, I was really sad to, I mean, it just, I keep remembering as I'm researching this, they're 19.
Right, and it, over $750.
Nothing.
And not that there's really any amount of money that would justify those kinds of actions, but it's just so trivial.
Yeah, what, for what? How do you place that kind of value on a human life?
Right.
And this, I mean, I can't imagine this wouldn't have continued
had he not been found.
There was no reason. He just chose people that he felt were easier targets for him.
Yeah.
You know, he chose someone who he felt was weak physically, and then he chose someone who he thought was sort of unpopular and shy.
Yeah.
And for what? And he had no remorse in how he talks about it. He doesn't seem to have a clue as to the, like, real weight of what it means to have taken human life away from other people. He just talks about it like something he, like telling a story, like something he did that day.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, I'll tell you what I did. Why do you ask? It's really
chilling.
Chilling and disturbing, especially when you hear his family, Mesa's family, talk about how he grew up and he was this aspirational guy and he was an inspiration to his community and had all of this stuff going for him and had gotten off of the island. He wanted to explore the world and this is what he does with his chance and his opportunity. For what?
Right.
For what? Oof. And then the audacity to face the family and offer your condolences. Disgusting.
So gross.
Yeah.
Well, how would you say the episode... How would you rate the episode?
Okay. I don't think it was terrible.
No.
I would give it like a... I'd give it a C+.
Interesting. Okay. I would agree with that. I think it was one of the better episodes of the season.
Yeah.
Definitely wasn't the strongest. Like, there was a lot of unnecessary, uninteresting red herring kind of moments.
Yes.
So I guess I would say C+. Mm-hmm. What about how it dealt with the themes?
I think it was okay. I think there were some... I don't think... The one thing I didn't love was this sort of idea that members of the deaf community have this vendetta-type feeling against the hearing or those in the deaf community who are seeking out, like, a cochlear implant or something like that. I don't think that's a real...
I'm sure that's
an experience that someone could have. Like, oh, that's... How do I, you know, view that? How do I view myself? How do I view people who do that? But I don't think it's a feeling of, like, violence and, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I don't, I can't speak to that. I kind of wondered the same thing. I was like, how accurate is it that there are members of the deaf community who would feel that cochlear implants would, are, like, not something folks should be doing? But I don't know whether that feeling is strong enough to... like, form an organization, which is kind of what the show did, but I would have to research more on that.
So, yeah, I don't know. So, I think I would give it, like, a soft C.
A soft C. I think I would agree with that. I appreciate that they hired primarily deaf actors for the deaf characters in the episode, at least, although, as we've seen in previous episodes, you know, they certainly cast folks and then give them stereotypical roles to portray, so I can't speak to how great the depictions were.
That's very true. I hadn't thought about that. Well, we're about to do our closing. Thank you guys so much for another great season. We have loved being able to do this. We've loved reaching out to more listeners, and we have really just been over the moon about this experience and can't wait for another season.
Yeah, season 4 coming next week.
I'm excited.
Here we go. Hey, if you're happy and you know it, subscribe to our podcast and write us a review, because leaving a review makes it more likely that somebody else will find our podcast.
Yes, and the best way for other people to find our podcast is through word of mouth. So tell a friend, post about us on Reddit, or find any other way you can to spread the word.
Yes, and no need to head to askjeeves.com. I will tell you how to find us right now. Our social media is Ripped Headlines on all platforms, and our email is rippedheadlinespod@gmail.com.
And while you're online, head on over to rippedheadlinespod.com, and you'll find the link to our Patreon there, as well as for our merch store.
Yes, and a percentage of our Patreon proceeds get donated to the Equal Justice Initiative, so by supporting us, you are also supporting positive change in the world.
And if you want to buy us a coffee, you can do that at buymeacoffee.com/nandmatt.
And shout out to our newest Patreon member, Fizzled. Thank you for signing up. We appreciate you.
Yes, and thank you so much for listening to Riff from the Headlines, where you get the facts and some fiction.
See you next week, and until then, stay out of the headlines.
Bye.